Bananas, we have no bananas today. We got string beans and onions and big juicy lemons and all kinds of fruit and say. We've got an old fashioned tomato, a Long Island potato.
Oh, yes,
we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Have you ever taken a big bite of a lovely looking piece of fruit only to discover that it's mealy or tasteless? Or have you chosen a melon that turned out to be dried out in the center? Well, today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the secrets of choosing the best fruits and vegetables. And joining me now are Russ Parsons, the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times and the author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And Jeff Bialas. He and his family grow some 80 different kinds of vegetables on their farm in Orange County, New York. And they sell their produce at green markets in New York City and the surrounding area. Very pleased to welcome them both to the show. And by the way, later we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. I'm sure you all have questions, and I'm not going to cover everything because there's just too much to cover. Russ, what's happened to a tomato or a peach to give it that unexpected hard graininess? Has it been picked too early?
In some cases, usually peaches and tomatoes are picked underripe. And the reason for that is because most of the peaches and tomatoes are harvested in California. To get them to New York, if they were picked ripe, when they arrived, they'd be nothing but little, you know, peach jam and tomato sauce pre-made. So they pick them a little bit ripe. They pick them a little bit underripe. And normally that can be okay because those are both tomatoes and peaches are fruits that will ripen off of the after they've been harvested. The problem is if they get chilled in the meantime, if you chill a peach before it's ripe, or if you chill a tomato before it's ripe, it destroys the flavor. With tomatoes, even if the tomato has been allowed to ripen, it just kills the flavor. With a peach, it creates this thing that they call chill injury, and that's exactly what you just described, the kind of mealy, dry, no flavor.
So when we bring them home from whether it's the supermarket or the green market or whatever, we should not put them in the refrigerator?
No, absolutely not.
I've been putting my tomatoes in the refrigerator and making a big mistake.
Oh, Leonard. No, never put a tomato in the
refrigerator. I thought it was a banana.
Don't put the tomato in the refrigerator either. And peaches, once they're allowed to ripen, once they start to soften and you get that great smell off of them, then you can put them in the refrigerator and they'll last a little bit longer, but not until then.
Jeff, you just came here from the farmer's market, the green market on 96th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. What time did you leave your farm this morning?
I woke up around 3 and loaded the truck and pulled out a little after 4.
And how long a trip is it?
It's not that long, about an hour and a half. It's only about 65 miles away, but with the big truck, and it takes a little while to get here. And I try to get here early so I can be set up for some early customers that come through the market early.
And you're also missing the more heated time of day, so you won't refrigerate your peaches.
No, actually we have just vegetables. Peaches, we have one tree for ourselves on the farm. So,
was most of what you brought with you to sell picked just recently?
We pick everything within a day or two of the market. Later in the season when potatoes and onions are in season, we can wash those earlier in the week or with onions, just, you know, grade them and take out any bad ones. And those are done like on a Monday or Tuesday. And then by Wednesday, Thursday, we're picking all the lettuces and the greens fresh for the market. So it's all picked very fresh and then cooled down right away so that way it doesn't spoil.
Well, you brought in some examples. But Russ, when we look at produce that's brought into us by local growers and then compare it with what we might buy in a supermarket, is it easy to spot the difference?
It's not always easy to spot it visually, but I think you can usually spot it in flavor.
Then you got to buy it and eat it, unless you're one of those people who eats in the store and, of course, you get into
trouble. Unless
you're
at the farmer's market and you ask for taste.
Yeah.
Pretty much anymore, I'm afraid, that if you're at a supermarket, It's pretty rare to find locally grown fruits and vegetables. I mean, California has developed this huge industry around supplying everybody in the country. More than half of all of the fruits and vegetables grown in the United States are grown in California. And the next leading state is Florida, and they only have about 10%. So almost everything that comes through that kind of mainstream produce stream has come from California.
In fact, 50% of all fruits and vegetables. But in the wintertime, there are some specialty tomatoes that are shipped up to New York every day by truck. I think it takes about a day for them to get up here. Mm-hmm. Is that, I know that's not 150 miles, which some people consider to be the rule, but is that still okay? Or should we really just try to live by tomatoes during the tomato season?
You're not going to goad me into making one of those Californian type statements.
About Florida?
Because I'm not dogmatic. I mean, we all have to live in the real world, and we have to do with what we can do. But you need to understand that there's trade-offs and there's compromises, and that when you're buying things that are grown far away, or when you're buying things that are out of season, that it may be something that you want. Go ahead and get it. But it's not going to be as good as it's going to be if you had bought it locally and if you had bought it when it was at its peak of season.
But don't some fruits and vegetables like apples and tomatoes continue to ripen after they've been picked?
Some fruits and vegetables do. Apples don't. Apples are but apples last forever. I mean, that's why apples are kind of the national fruit, because it was something that could be harvested in October, November, and it would last. You could put it in cold storage underneath the house so that you would have something besides dried fruit to eat in February and January.
Jeff, in general, when we're trying to choose for freshness, it's probably most important to know what's in season. So do you think that most Americans know what's in season in their area?
I think overall most people don't have any idea, just because of everything coming from all over the country. They can get pretty much anything they want at any time of the year, and not even just this country. You're getting things from all over the world. I still have times at the market where people that aren't regular market customers come by and say, do you have any bananas? Do you have any mangoes? And I'm like, this is a local farmer's market. We don't grow those locally. And they just, a lot of people don't know. But more and more are learning. So that's part of my job, is to go there and like help teach people.
So what did you bring in today?
I brought some spinach for you. I said Swiss chard and arugula from our greenhouse. The spinach actually wintered over. It was too small in December to pick for market and survived under the snow and started growing first thing this spring. I'm trying to think what else I brought. I brought some popcorn from you, which is actually a storage. We pick, grow that, and then it has a dry for between 3 and 6 months, and then so we grow two varieties of popcorn. And
You brought in some herbs, I think.
Oh, there's some thyme, and I think some chocolate mint.
And I want to get to the herbs later, but wasn't there a late frost this year?
There was.
Does that do?
It wouldn't have been bad, except we had so much nice weather when everything was growing so lush. And then you had this, we got down to 27 degrees last week. And even things that normally wouldn't be affected, like broccoli and peas, some of them burned right down to the ground.
So we're not getting snap peas?
We will get them. They're just behind schedule. The whole plant wasn't killed. It was just burned an inch or two down the plant. And so that way it'll just be, another 2 weeks behind the normal. Like, we're actually 3 weeks behind anyway because of the cold spring, and now it's an extra 2 weeks on top of that. And so look for them around 4th of July.
But does that mean that we'll get less of a crop, or because you have no guarantees that it's going to stay warmer longer either?
The chances are better now that it's going to stay warmer. The later we get into the season, the better chances are you're going to have better weather. Usually they say last frost in this area is between the 15th and 20th of May. We've had them as late as first week of June. We've had times where we haven't had a frost after the 1st of May. So it's, it just really depends. It's season to season. It's one of the guessing games of farming.
You brought in some spinach, you said. In the case of spinach, what should we be looking for? Because this spinach that you have here is really, feels fresh. It's almost crackly. I don't know how to describe it. And I know when I go into my local store, even decent spinach, there's a kind of a slightly wilted quality to it.
A lot of it is how it's handled in the beginning, and you want to look for that nice shine and the crunch to it. We make sure that with everything we grow, we wash everything, first of all. So if someone wants to try something at the market, it's already been washed once. Obviously, you wash it again when you get home just
because
to rinse
spinach has so much sand in it.
Well, actually, our soil isn't sandy, and so most of the dirt does actually come out. If you take a look at it, you'll see there's almost no dirt in it. But we wash everything, first of all, to get some of the dirt off, but secondly, to keep some moisture on it when we put it into our cold storage. And that way, it's naturally just going to dehydrate after it's harvested, and that water is going to help it, you know, dehydrate slower.
You know? My guests on Please Explain today are Jeff Bialas, who has a family farm in Orange County, New York, and sells much of what he grows in farmers markets in the area. And Russ Parsons, the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's written a book called How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. And Russ, the big problem for you, I'm assuming, is that you're in California, where there's a lot more fresh stuff year-round than there is in other parts of the country. So you had to kind of figure out what it was like to live in Minnesota or New York or Maine or Wisconsin.
Before I moved to California, I lived in New Mexico, and where nothing grows. I mean, we're talking desert, high desert. It's even much worse than Minnesota.
Ocotillo cactus.
When I moved to California, that was kind of that first thing that really kind of got me interested in that conjunction of agriculture and cooking, was because all of a sudden I realized that when it rained. I mean, it wasn't all of a sudden. I'm not that bright. It took a couple months. But when it rained, the strawberries weren't as good. And I kept wondering, why is that? Well, it's because they were grown in Southern California. They were grown within 10 or 15 miles of me.
And now most of the strawberries we see until the late season here in New York are those Driscoll strawberries. They all look the same. I'm sure that there's a special breed or a species of strawberry that allows them to all look like
that. There are several varieties. In California, there are two main producers. One of them is Driscoll, and then another one is another growers cooperative that grows from University of California-sponsored varieties. But all of them, strawberries were not intended to be shipped across country. It's an unnatural demand that we're making of them. And so the plant breeders have had to make adjustments in what they're looking for in terms of strawberries. I mean, strawberries today, unless you can get them from a farmer's market, and fortunately they are one of the most widely grown farmer's market fruits, the textures and the aromas aren't anything like what you remember.
So let's talk about aromas for a moment. Is that a good way to determine freshness? Just stick your nose in it, and I ask the both of you that.
I think for most things that would, you know, help.
So it doesn't bother you when people come up to your stand at a green market and stick their nose into
the... I'd prefer if they pulled off a little piece of the green or the lettuce or whatever it is and they can just chomp down and enjoy.
That's particularly true with fruits, because fruits have aroma built in, because the purpose of the fruit is to distribute the seed, and so fruits are designed to be delicious. Vegetables are kind of accidentally delicious because they fulfill other functions on the plant. So one of the best ways of enticing things to eat the fruit is by aroma. And so, you know, if you ever have a question, if you're at the market and you ever have a question about what's best, sniff around, and your nose will probably tell you which direction you ought to go.
Well, one of the hardest things for me to determine the freshness or the taste of is oranges. California oranges, mm-hmm. Florida oranges, doesn't matter. They all look pretty much the same. They all look orange. And unless they're bumpy or something else has happened to them, the only way I can even assume that one is better than the other is by price. Because one bin next to the other, I'm assuming that two for a dollar is going to be better than five for a dollar. But I have no way of knowing. And can I smell it? Can I squeeze it? Is there some special
citrus
way?
Citrus has some smell. I mean, if you scratch your thumbnail across the rind, you'll get some of the oils out, and the oils do dry up after the fruit's been picked. But with things like citrus, the best way to choose is by weight. So choose something that's heavy for its size, because the main thing that happens in storage is that the produce loses moisture, and when it loses moisture, it becomes lighter, because 85 to 90% of almost all fruits and vegetables is water.
So a heavy orange is going to be good. A heavy tomato, I'm assuming,
it's going
would
to be
also
better.
Be good.
Yeah.
What about baby vegetables, Jeff? A lot of people think that baby vegetables are better. He just told us that as far as fruit is concerned, the bigger the better. Or at least the heavier the better.
No, I said the heavier.
Yeah, because the bigger can also... I've had some watermelons that were huge that had absolutely no flavor.
Right.
I personally don't find that baby vegetables are any better. I know they're definitely more time-consuming on my end to pick and to wash. I think most important is fresh. If you can get it fresh, that's make, you know, even if a giant head of lettuce that's fresh is going to be better than a baby green shipped across the country.
And lots of different kinds of there's lots of different kinds of baby vegetables, and some of them are things that are actually picked immature, like greens. But then things like carrots. I mean, I'm not talking about the whittled baby carrots that you buy at the grocery store, but
because those are really old carrots that they've just simply put through a machine to make them look like baby carrots and
right.
get rid of all the outside
right. But at
cookie
the
stuff.
At the farmer's market, there are varieties that are specially bred to be small. And then you get things like artichokes. And the same artichoke plant will throw off huge artichokes and also just little tiny artichokes. So it's more of a sorting process rather than pick to mature.
Well, how do I know what's a good artichoke? Does it have to kind of puncture my finger on the tip to be
well,
good?
Well, that sharp tip is varietal, and it doesn't really have all that much to do. The best way to choose an artichoke is check the bottom of the base of the stem. On the cut end there, and make sure there's no mold or anything, because they mold very, very quickly. Black is fine, because artichokes turn black almost instantly, but just no mold. And then grab the head and rub the leaves together. And if the leaves squeak, that's a really good sign that they're fresh, because they've still got vigor.
And by the way, you can get locally grown artichokes. We'll have them probably around the end of July. We grow our own artichokes.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a customer today ask me how the plants are doing. He checks in every single week and said, how are the artichokes? They still going? So,
What varieties are you growing?
Imperial Star.
I'm sorry?
Imperial Star. It's green one. It's one of the shorter day ones that we can grow in this area.
And it's a seed-started one, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have to start the seeds. The plants were just put out in the fields a couple weeks ago, and they should be ready, like I said, around the end of July.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with your calls to my guests, Russ Parsons, who's written a book called How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And Jeff Bialas, who has one of the farms that produce items for the green markets of New York City. Today they were at the green market on Amsterdam Avenue and, what was it, 97th Street. And our number here is 212-433-9692. That's area code 212-433-WNYC.
Nah, I don't want vanilla. I don't want chocolate. Bring me some of that good tutti frutti. Tutti frutti frutti. Tutti frutti frutti. Tutti frutti frutti.
We're back with today's Please Explain. Our guest, Jeff Bialas, whose family farm grows 80 different kinds of vegetables in Orange County, New York. They bring them to us here. I don't know if it's within 150 miles, but it's close enough to the 150-mile rule. Is it? Is
actually,
it?
We're only about 60, 65 miles away.
Oh,
so
well.
Less as the crow flies, so I guess if you count that, it's even closer.
And there are a lot of crows bringing in Indeed. The produce that he grows, at least the stuff that he has to consider as spoilage. Mm-hmm. Russ Parsons is the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he has written a wonderful book, by the way. We just love this book.
Oh, thank you, Leonard.
It's called we wouldn't have had you here if it weren't. It was really good. You know, we try not to invite guests who don't know what they're talking
maybe
about.
Maybe you'd have me on and make fun of me or something.
Well, it's called How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table from Houghton Mifflin. It also includes 100 recipes and tips on selecting, storing, and cooking fruits and vegetables, because storage is really important. I just found out I've been doing something terrible to my tomatoes. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692, and let's go right to John from Bergen County. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello, Lynn. How are you today?
I'm well. And you?
Very well, thank you. A couple of things. I have Mr. Richter's produce guy, which I received a few months back, which gives a listing of all the produce. But one thing I've noticed is that they seem to promote, not they, but supermarkets seem to promote these so-called seedless watermelons. And I've always been the impression that two things. One, pick a watermelon tends to be round rather than a cucumber shape. and try to find a watermelon with seeds, which are better than the ones that are seedless. Am I correct in that assumption?
Seedless watermelons, or are they better or are they worse? I think
seeded,
it varies.
I understand seeded watermelons are better than the seedless, which seems to be the ones you can only find nowadays.
Yeah.
And I had heard that you should try to get a watermelon that tends to be round like a basketball rather than the cucumber-shaped ones.
Well, first of all, let's talk about seedless, because there are seedless grapes, there are seedless watermelons, more and more things are coming seedless. It's always been my sense that the things with the seeds have more flavor, but on the other hand, they're less convenient.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. Seedlessness is something that they breed for, and sometimes they compromise flavor along the way, and sometimes you end up with seedless products that actually have good flavor, like Satsuma mandarins and clementines. I mean,
right.
That's a nice piece of fruit, and it's still seedless. Navel oranges are seedless, and seedlessness is one of those weird things because when you think about it, it's like, well, if they're seedless, how do they go beyond one generation? But there are different reasons different things are seedless. As far as seedless watermelons, I have to be honest, a good seedless watermelon tastes as good as a seeded watermelon to me.
Well, what about picking a watermelon?
That's the old thump test. You guys do watermelons?
We actually don't.
Well, so the trick with watermelons, and it's a little bit hard to picture sometimes because until you hear it right, it's hard to identify it. But if you think of a hollow core door instead of a solid wood door, because what's happening with a watermelon is that as it ripens, that seed cavity is opening up a little bit. You know, if you've seen an underripe watermelon, it's solid all the way through. As the seed cavity opens up a little bit, then you get some resonance when you knock on it. So if you think of a cheap hollow core door instead of an expensive solid wood door, and then you pick the cheap one, you're going to be okay.
So you're looking for hollowness in this one case.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your call, John. We go now to Harrison from Norwalk, Connecticut. Hi, Harrison.
Hey, gentlemen. I was inspired by the title of the book, and I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and used to love to eat ripe, juicy peaches. And I find that the peaches that I buy in New England, they look pretty, and then they go straight from being hard, crunchy, to mealy and spoiled. Is it possible to get a good peach in New England?
It is, but it's probably any time I hear the word mealy associated with peach, it makes me think that they've been refrigerated somewhere along the line. It may not have been you. It could have been the store had them in the chiller, or they could have been chilled on the truck.
Could it also be that he is not getting them in season because there's a rather limited season for peaches in New England, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely.
So he's probably getting them before the peach season. You just have to find out from local farmers. And this takes a certain amount of research, doesn't it, just when the peach season is?
Right, and especially with peaches, because peaches are just a devilsome fruit for the farmer because they're really, really difficult to grow. And when you grow them in New England where the summers are hot and humid, you get all kinds of funguses. There's all kinds of problems that go. So there aren't very many peaches that are grown in New England.
Do people come up to you at the farmer's market, Jeff, and ask you what is the right season? Are people open to learning that sort of thing?
Absolutely. People really want to learn about what we do because, you know, not too many years ago, a lot of people lived on farms or were close to a farm, and they want to get back to that, really, you know, made them feel closer to the earth and closer to their community.
Now, a number of people want to know whether your farm is organic and whether organic is better, whether you use pesticides.
We're not organic. Some of the techniques and things that we use are considered sustainable. At the same time, I've done a lot of research on my own concerning that, and I don't necessarily believe a lot of the hype that's about organic. I think local is much more important and getting to know your farmer. That's why we have someone from our farm at every market. One family member, at least, goes to every market so we can answer questions about it. I have a 4-year-old and a 15-month-old, and I have no trouble at all bringing them in the fields and eating things unwashed right off our farm.
I completely agree. I think one of the real disservices that's happened in the last 10 or 15 years has been this kind of using organic as a catchword for what we really want to think of as small farmers, sustainable farmers, responsible farmers. And, you know, we've kind of created this black and white world where there's pure, innocent organic farmers and then, you know, dirty, evil, pesticide-dripping other farmers. And the reality is much more nuanced, and there's a huge gray area in between.
Well, sometimes you can go into a place like Whole Foods and buy organic and then later discover it was organic in Chile.
Right.
So it still was picked a while ago and flown or taken by boat. over a great distance, but it was organic.
It's organic, but what does it really mean? I mean, for me, the bottom line is flavor, because flavor is the one thing that can't be faked. I mean, organic, you can push the limit of organic. You can pump fruit full of water so that you get a huge yield and it looks beautiful. You can't fake flavor.
Although there are many organic pieces of produce that are quite wonderful, and there's always a trade-off. This price is another trade-off, isn't there? And would you be able to grow organically? You have to get special certification, don't you, Jeff?
I don't even think we could in our area, just because there are very few people in our area that grow organically, and you have to worry about buffer zones between your farm and the next farm. And our soil is prone to insects and diseases because it's called muckland. It's black dirt. It was actually a wetland and lake bottom when the glaciers receded 10,000 years ago. It was formed, and over years of this. Leaves and everything settling to the bottom, that turned into what is now our soil. And so it's still quite wet, and you can get diseases on a wet year. And so you really have to be able to control that, and you really can't control it well with organic techniques.
Let's go to Selma from Manhattan. Hi, Selma. You're on the air.
Hi. My problem is, I love Anjou pears. And when I'm in the store, get them. They're usually hard, so I take them home and a few days, wait for a few days. But they're still hard. Or when they get soft, then it takes years for them to get soft. And it's hard. So what's the best way of getting?
I think what she's asking is not just about Anjou pears, but a whole bunch of things that are available hard at the store. Avocados being perhaps the most egregious example. And then you buy them, you take them and hope that they're going to ripen well. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't.
If you're finding that you're having a hard time, things are ripening slow, you can use the old trick of putting them in a paper bag. And if you'll put a cut apple in the paper bag, that'll help too. Because apples emit ethylene gas, and the ethylene gas is used by plants as a triggering mechanism for ripening. So that'll speed it along a little better.
But normally, are they hard because they were picked too young?
They're hard because they're picked underripe. But as you said, lots of fruits are, scientists call them climacteric fruits because they continue to ripen after they've been picked. And peaches, nectarines, avocados, pears. If you ripen a pear on the tree, you got a piece of wood. You can't eat a. They're almost inedible. They have to be picked underripe.
My problem with avocados is that some places you can only get them rock hard, and you don't know how many days it's going to take for them to finally ripen. So you can't really plan out any kind of a meal. You just keep them there, and you hope that
it's really frustrating.
And you hope that they don't develop black spots while they're ripening, too.
I've got an avocado tree at my house, and I tell you, it's really frustrating, even with a tree. Because
really? I thought that's a reason to move to California.
Well, avocados are another fruit that has to be picked underripe. They don't ripen on the tree. You can leave them on the tree for 2 years, and they won't ripen. They won't get soft.
Beatrice from Great Neck. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling about lettuces. I'd like to know what causes some of the blemishes or the problems with lettuce. For instance, with iceberg, often the white part will be pinkish or will have brownish speckles, and that usually goes through the whole head of lettuce. And on the leaf lettuces, such as romaine, often once you get inside, there are brownish soft spots, and that also goes through the whole head. So,
let me add to that, with red leaf and green leaf, sometimes they have a kind of a slimy feeling to them.
That's also true, yeah.
So, Jeff, you grow lettuces, don't you?
Yes. In our experience, most of that occurs in the fields. Some of it could be after harvest, but for us, if we get some heat during the summer when it's about ready to harvest, the lettuce heats up too much, and that'll cause some of it near the base of the plant where it's near the ground. Some of the speckles, there's some diseases and... Not as many insects as other things have problems with, but the speckles and the rotten spots, for us, we found a problem with the heat. The heat is the worst, the humidity, the hot days in the summer.
So what's the answer? Just simply
just cut it out.
Cut those
just
parts off?
Just trim it off. It won't hurt you. A lot of things that people don't want to see on their produce is just it's a physical thing only. It's not going to bother you at all.
And should the rule with lettuce be a certain amount of crispness?
Yeah, you don't want limp lettuce. But a trick, if you have to have it, if you find it in your fridge and it's, you know, kind of limp, just rinse it in cold water. And then I just wrap it in a paper towel or a cloth towel, stick it in a bag, and stick it in the fridge. And it should perk right back up for you.
And also, when you're shopping for them, if you, especially with head lettuces, they should be tight. Because when you get that kind of heat bolting with lettuces, they open up, and so there's a lot of air in between the leaves. And so when you squeeze them, they'll feel pillowy instead of like a bowling ball.
Laura from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I've always wanted to know if a fruit or a vegetable is tasty. Does that make it more nutritious than if it were not as tasty? Because, you see, I don't have too much money. I would say I'm poor. And I eat it whether it's the tastiest or not the tastiest, hoping that I'm still getting my nutritional value.
I haven't seen any studies that convinced me that there's a tremendous variation in nutritional value between fruits and vegetables that are flavorful or aren't flavorful, or that are organic or that aren't organic. I think vegetable fruits and vegetables lose some of their nutrients over time, but I'm not convinced that it's an appreciable amount that would make a difference actually.
We thank you so much for your call. I have a couple of questions for Jeff from listeners who've written in through email. One is, Russ, you're invited to answer them as well. This one is, are green, orange, and red peppers all the same vegetable at different stages of maturity? Why are the orange and the red ones so much more expensive than the green?
Well, most peppers start out green. We do grow a variety of white peppers that start out white and actually turn a reddish pink color. But most of them start green and then turn their red or their orange. And a big reason for the cost difference is that a lot of peppers will rot at that stage, because as they're ripening, they're getting ready to put their seed out, and they'll get a spot that starts to rot through where eventually the seeds will drop and the fruit will drop to the ground. So the farmer is losing a lot more of his product to get it to be a red pepper.
But the red pepper is sweeter than the green pepper.
Well, it's a ripe pepper at that stage. A green pepper is technically underripe.
And this person asks, please talk about shopping for summer corn. My pet peeve is seeing people peeling apart the husks at the green market and tossing their rejects back in the bin. Doesn't this speed up the conversion of sugar into starch and kind of ruin the corn?
Well, it is sort of my pet peeve also, and I try to dissuade people from opening it up, because we try to show them how to pick it without having to open it. Really, if you squeeze the top of the corn with your thumb, you can feel if the kernels are full right to the tip. And I tell them it's better to have it a little bit not quite to the tip, because if it's full all the way to the tip, the kernels at the base where they first start forming are actually a little bit older and they're a little bit starchier. But anyone is welcome to come down to the market middle to the end of July and come down and try some corn.
But how do we know what's good if we don't at least take a little peek at those kernels?
Well, you ask the person selling it, and if they don't know, then you have to invest even just by one ear, whether it's a quarter or 50 cents. You buy one ear and you try it. And if it doesn't taste good, you've only lost 50 cents. You go over on the side, you eat your corn, you know, on the sly.
Eat it raw.
Absolutely. Corn is great raw. I probably have 20 or 30 people a day at the markets eating corn in season.
I'm a really bad customer because I always just peel back the very tip of it and take a look and see if it's filled out. What kind of corn do you grow? Because there's all those new super sweet varieties that are doing great.
We don't like the super sweets. I find that they don't taste good raw, and they're also, excuse me, too sweet. I like a lot of corn flavor. We do this butter and sugar.
Mm-hmm.
There's different varieties, actually. There's one.
And that's a golden and white one, too,
yes,
right?
Yes, a yellow and white mix.
And are they sweet because of sugar? Because corn now is a major supplier of sweeteners.
Well, there obviously is sugar in it, but we like to get try different varieties and see which ones have the best combination of sweetness as well as corn flavor. And you want a good balance there. We don't want it too sweet, and we don't want it too rich corn and nuts. You know, like a cornmeal. You don't want like a hearty corn flavor with no sweetness at all.
Now, earlier we started talking about herbs, and I put you off, but herbs seem to me to be one of the oddities here, because we use them fresh and we use them dried, and the flavor doesn't change all that much, does it? What is the advantage of one or the other?
Some things the flavor is really dramatically different. The difference between dried basil and fresh basil is really, really dramatic. Some things are better
and also
dried.
The smell.
Yeah, exactly.
Something
well,
like
it's all
about
smell.
Fresh basil, that is just one of the most exciting things in the world.
I think some things are actually better dried. Oregano, fresh oregano is really, really assertive. But the dried oregano, it seems to lose a little bit of that edge, so it tastes a little bit better. What do you find?
I actually prefer fresh herbs just because I like to add them towards the end of cooking so you have that full flavor. Mm-hmm. And also I love to add them when I make frittatas with fresh herbs all the time. And I find that dry ones don't come across as well. I don't have the flavor.
Frittata, that'd be awful.
You know, it's just too dry, and I like fresh. I like quick cooking, and so I want... if I'm doing long cooking, like you said about the oregano, sure, I would put the dried in a sauce or something and let it cook down, and the flavor will come out that way. But I personally prefer fresh herbs.
Another listener writes, why are zucchini and cucumbers bitter sometimes? How can I pick out non-bitter zucchini and cucumbers?
I'm not really...
The bitterness from cucumber comes usually when there's been a real heat spike or when there's been an excessive dryness. And that bitterness is actually the thing that makes people burp. And the thing to get around that is just peel it. Peel it well, peel it deeply. Most of the compound that makes it taste bitter is going to be located right under the skin or just at the stem end.
We have time for maybe one or two more calls. Phil from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I'd like to know if there's a resource either online or in print that will help people like me find farms in their areas so that they can visit them and build relationships with the people who work there.
I'm not really sure of an exact website where you can go to. I would just say, you know, do a search and type in some different keywords such as, you know, farm and maybe CSA, because a lot of people that do CSAs have people that come to the farms. You build a relationship directly with the farmer. Other than that, I'm not really quite sure.
Isn't there a Green Market Association here?
The Green Market website.
They might have some links.
Yeah, they probably have links.
So. Now, is there a consolidation of farms? Are we seeing larger and larger factory farms up in the Hudson Valley, or is that where... farmers continue to hold out?
Well, actually, more and more changing like we did. We used to grow first all celery and then all onions and almost went out of business because of it, because wholesale is just horrible.
Yeah, well, so that was what we call monoculture.
Yeah. And so we switched over to farmers markets, and more people in our area are doing that. And so you see actually a lot more small farms, small 10, 15, 20 acres growing mixed vegetables, as opposed to what used to be 10,000 acres of onions in our area. And so now it's, you know, 5,000 acres of onions, or give or take, and then all these different greens, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different vegetables now.
Now, before you go, my staff has a question about tomatoes. Somebody, anyway, believes that cherry tomatoes tend to taste good year-round and often taste better than regular-sized tomatoes. I'm not sure I agree, but... what is it about cherry tomatoes? Do we grow them locally?
We do. We grow a few different varieties. We grow the cherry, we grow grape, and actually I'm doing a new one, an heirloom cherry tomato this year. It's actually slightly brownish. It's called brown berry. And haven't tried it yet. It's not, you know, obviously not producing fruit yet, but cherry tomatoes, I don't find them better as much. I think they have their purpose, but...
I do find heirloom tomatoes better.
Absolutely.
In many cases. I don't know why they have so much flavor, why we don't have more of them.
I think one thing that's really important is to remember that that produce is grown, it's not manufactured, and you're not buying a brand name. So it's not, you know, buying a Brandywine tomato isn't like buying a Cadillac. It still comes down to the farmer and having a good farmer.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. He's also the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And Jeff Bialas is a family farmer. His family grows some 80 different kinds of vegetables, and they're farm in Orange County, New York. And you can find them at any number of green markets around the city. At Union Square ever?
No, actually, the only market we do here in the city is at 97 in Columbus.
Which you were at today.
Yes, but actually we have a website where people can find our other locations. It's bialasfarms.com, and that has our list of all of our markets that we go to.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.